ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Grow up, get a job, leave home used to be the usual trajectory, but more families are seeing adult children living at home for longer. So what does that mean for parents? Because new research confirms what lots of us already know, the intensive phase of parenting doesn't stop when your child turns 18. And parents are putting their own milestones on hold to keep providing financial and emotional support. But is that just what we sign up for when we have kids? Also ahead, for many industries, doing a bit of free work experience feels like the cost of entry. In some jobs, it's actually required. But at some stage, an internship can stop being experience and start looking like exploitation. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, do you have your eye on a new toaster or a TV, a laptop, maybe an outfit for the office Christmas party? Maybe you've already clicked add to cart a few times over the past couple of weeks because it is sales season. Black Friday takes place on the last Friday of every November. This year it's the 28th. But come on, it's no longer just a day. It feels more like a month-long retail extravaganza these days. This year, Australians are expected to spend $6.8 billion over the Black Friday, Cyber Monday period. And the nation's consumer watchdog says it's conducting a sweep of retailers' claims. Already, the ACCC has fined three major retailers for making false and misleading representations about last year's Black Friday sales. So how did Black Friday evolve from a US phenomenon to our biggest sales event? And what impact is it having on year-round spending? I'd love to know from you if you're a Black Friday shopper. Has it changed the way you spend money the rest of the year, especially in the last couple of months of the year? With me is Gary Mortimer, a professor of consumer behaviour and retail marketing at QUT Business School, and Fleur Brown, chief of industry affairs officer at the Australian Retailers Association. Gary, I'll start with you. What do we know about what Black Friday looks like in Australia over the past few years?
Yeah, good morning. It's really changed, hasn't it? And I'm sure your listeners have realised that, yeah, really at the beginning of November, we start to see those big signs and adverts start to roll out, particularly across social media. It's become more and more popular. I think what's driving it is shoppers really looking for a bargain. And essentially, we're becoming more savvy when it comes to saving. So we're not leaving all of our shopping to the last minute, like unfortunately I still tend to do. We tend to do it much earlier, and we start to take advantage of those big sales. So we've got Black Friday obviously happening throughout this month, but particularly at the end of this month. I think on the 18th of this month, Amazon will be pulling out their Black Friday sales. They're coming out a bit earlier. We just had Click Frenzy, Australia's online retail sales event, and that was last week for 3 days. And then we had Singles Day, which is something that's slowly creeping into the Australian retail sector. Often a lot of jewellery and cosmetic Australian brands compete in that space.
Fleur, you say November is the new December. What do you mean by that?
Well, as Gary was saying, people are bringing their shopping forward, particularly for Christmas. So I think a lot of this has to do with the cost of living crisis that many Australian households are still experiencing. They're looking to get things off their shopping list at an affordable price. And so Black Friday presents a really great opportunity to do that. But also picking up on what Gary was saying, we've seen a sort of a slow trend towards earlier shopping. There were lots of factors in the last few years that have influenced that, like concern about whether or not people will be able to get the product that they want, you know, getting their deliveries sorted when there's a lot of congestion in the distribution system. And I think those habits have stuck.
Gary, when I'm hearing Fleur say things like wondering about getting your hands on the product or worries about delivery, that really plays into that sense of scarcity that I know is a marketing tactic. How much of this is people maybe being marketed, this idea of scarcity versus the actual scarcity?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I often get asked, is now the right time to buy or should I wait until the end of November or should I wait even till the the beginning of December? What we tend to see is that retailers will continually put out brand new ranges of offers. So, you know, I'm looking for a particular stick vacuum cleaner. It's not on special yet, but I'm going to wait until it becomes on special. So I think the idea of scarcity will always be the case. I think first point about logistics is incredibly challenging. And you only need to look at the Australia Post data as we move into December. If you're buying anything from overseas, you know, you really need to be buying it now. If you're going to shop domestically, really, the cutoff date tends to be sort of very early December now, or there is a risk of missing out. So it's not just the fact that I might miss out on that great deal. It's also the fact that I might find the deal, but it may not arrive before Christmas.
What about this ACCC warning about Black Friday? Gary, what kind of traps are there out there?
Yeah, I think the ACCC is really concerned, not necessarily about our big sort of, flagship retailers, but it's most likely what we're seeing is sort of the online pure play retailers, generally, ghost stores. And I know about 6 months ago, we wrote a piece around ghost stores sort of popping up onto, you know, Facebook. They look legitimate. They look great. And the challenge that I guess that shoppers have is that during these peak trading periods where we're making very fast decisions, we're trying to not miss out on that special, we may go down that little rabbit warren of clicking on a link and thinking it looks like a legitimate product when in fact actually it's not. So they're very concerned about that. They're also very concerned about sort of any sort of online, you know, players that might be suggesting it's a site-wide discount when in fact it's only a few items and the rest of it's sort of, you know, the normal price. And I think we just, as consumers, we need to be concerned about those sort of those scams that do play out. And they unfortunately play out throughout the year, but they do tend to spike during these big peak trading periods.
Fleur, what does it feel like as sort of representing retailers hearing these warnings going around about scams and stuff? Are you worried that customers might be spooked?
Well, there's not a little sign of that.
Okay, right.
So we're projecting a 4% increase year on year for Black Friday this year. So the growth continues and online does influence a lot of that growth. So still a good chunk of shopping is transacted in store, but the online research, et cetera, comparing prices is influencing that. So look, we would always encourage consumers to do their research, shop with known and trusted brands, and that actually plays into the hands of our Australian retailers in a positive way. You know, the trusted local retailer that have boots on the ground here, they've got, you know, real people behind the offer. There's much less chance of a scam if that's the case. And we're certainly encouraging people to steer away from the ultra cost global retailers like Temu and Shein, where there've been concerns about their accountability, whether it be the quality of their product, ethical sourcing, supply chain challenges, that kind of thing, the use of your data, if you have that data captured. So we do have question marks around that. And in fact, you know, we're in discussions about that with government.
Fleur, I was interested to hear you say before that cost of living is driving Black Friday sales. I was participating in shopping Black Friday sales. That feels counterintuitive to me. Can you talk me through what you see?
Well, we've seen Aussies love their shopping, you know, full stop. And that's been a good antidote to the cost of living crisis where people have really, tried to balance their budget. But what we've seen is lots of spikes in spending during these sales events, these bargain hunting events. They've seen a lot of growth. And so we find that Aussies are saving up for purchases during those periods. So they may have things on their list. For example, I've got a couple of things that my 14-year-old daughter has required for this Christmas. And, I'm certainly going to have a look and see what offers come on for Black Friday to see if I can secure those items at a lower price. And that kind of planning and purchase behaviour has been a trend, not just for Black Friday, but for other periods, like, you know, it might be end of financial year sale where you're trying to get things for your kids for school, you know, or technology items, that sort of thing. There's that kind of planning approach where you wait and see if you can get it at a lower price.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Fleur Brown, who's the Chief Industry Affairs Officer at the Australian Retailers Association, and Professor Gary Mortimer from QUT Business School about Black Friday sales. In Australia, it's our biggest shopping event. It's so much more than a day now. And alongside all of the sales are warnings from the consumer watchdog that there are some scams afoot as well. So I'm trying to give you as much information as you can have so that you can shop wisely, if at all. But I'd really love to know if you have changed the way you spend money the rest of the year because of Black Friday becoming such a big thing in Australia. And a fair bit of cynicism on the text line. Black Friday has led to obscene toxic consumption. We get sucked in again and again. Liz says, Black Friday, meh. I see the word frenzy and just move on. Whose frenzy? Not ours. Another says, contrasts the cost of living and high electricity bills anxiety with the spending on shopping, says madness. It lowers my empathy for the complaints about the economy. Gary, is there a cultural sort of divide between the US Black Friday and what we see in Australia?
Oh, listen, I think we went back many decades, quite possibly. But I think we in Australia do pick up other other types of cultural norms. And, you know, good examples would be Halloween, which if we went back two decades, you know, maybe we'd buy some lollies and give them to street kids. Now Halloween has become a significant retail and social cultural event. And it's not just about giving out lollies to kids who knock on your door. We see neighbourhoods actually getting their homes dressed up now. We see people coming out and having barbecues on their front lawn and meeting new friends. It's becoming a social activity. I think that Christmas in July very much a US phenomenon, very much a British and European phenomenon that we're starting to adopt and have done over the last few decades. So I think Black Friday has just become another event which we would have seen play out on The Simpsons or Seinfeld or US sitcoms, and suddenly we're talking about it. Then the next thing, we've got US brands that we buy in Australia sort of talking about Black Friday promotions, and then Aussie retailers pick up on it. It becomes a four-day event, becomes a week-long event, and now becomes a month-long event. So I think the other thing we're seeing is not just retailers playing in this space, but we've seen, airlines getting involved now. We've got holiday tourism campaigns getting involved in Black Friday, because businesses understand that we're now thinking about Christmas and we're thinking about possibly January, where we take, you know, breaks and leave. What a great time to book a cruise. What a great time to book a flight. What a great time to book a holiday as well.
That's a strange one, isn't it? Because I can imagine a clearance event if you're a retailer with like physical stock, but what's going on when you're clearing airline seats?
Yeah, I think it just goes to show how competitive many markets are. So the tourism, hospitality, travel market, airline market. Most people will start to travel and then there'll be periods where people are already on holidays and they're not travelling. Until they travel back. So it's now about sort of getting people into airlines. I noticed that there was an airline doing sort of flights to Rome and to Paris for around about 1,350 return, ex-Sydney. Now, you think the only time you really want to go to Europe is generally in summer, not in the middle of winter. Okay. So you want to get bums on seats and get them up into Europe during the winter.
On the text line, one says, please consider the small local retailers in your community. They cannot compete with the current trend to the online November sales. Those characterful high street stores that you love to wander through on the weekend rely on their Christmas December sales for their very survival. They'll disappear if you don't support them. Fleur, how do smaller retailers fare when there is such a huge amount of deep discounting by big retailers on something like Black Friday?
Well, I think it does become a conversation for retailers to have with their customers. I mean, I was at the shops yesterday, and lots of my favourite smaller retailers having conversations with them about, you know, what their promotional plans are for Black Friday, what's likely to go on sale, what won't. Now, they're not always allowed to give you that information, but I got enough information to kind of plan, and I'm going to go back and purchase something for my daughter, you know, at that time. So it is about that that relationship that you have. And I think that's where smaller retailers can have an advantage. They've got that loyalty factor. Look, there is so much focus on loyalty these days. It's important for retailers to make sure that they make good commitments to their customers. They honour those commitments. If they put out a false promotion, that's just going to backfire on them, you know, down the track. It is a loyalty game at this point.
Gary, again on the text line, I'm seeing a lot of people kind of wondering about the whether it's ethical at all to consume in this sort of manner, whether it's compatible with trying to save our money. What's your advice to people who want to navigate this time of year ethically?
Yeah, it's a good point. And when you look at what the ARA's put out on a projection, we're talking about a 4% growth on last year. 4% is quite sustainable. You know, if those numbers were sort of, you know, 12%, you'd be going, gee, people are borrowing a lot of money to spend a lot of money. But really, a 4% growth is slightly just above what we're seeing with the RBA's inflation numbers that came out at the start of this month. So it's not unsustainable. I think what we would normally see is that people do generally do Christmas shopping. You know, we do like to spoil our kids and our family in most cases. And I think what we're seeing now in November is that shift of that promotional calendar, as Fleur was mentioning, that shoppers are concerned about budgeting. They're concerned about that cost of living crisis, but they understand that Christmas is still going to happen. How do we do it in a more sustainable way? Well, we start buying a little bit of stuff in the first week of November. We might do a little bit more shopping this week. As we move into early December, we start to do a little bit more shopping. And when we hit mid-December, it's all about sort of, you know, food and family gatherings, and hopefully by that stage everything's wrapped underneath the Christmas tree.
Gary, Fleur, thank you both so much this morning for joining me. Gary Mortimer is a Professor of Consumer Behaviour and Retail Marketing at QUT Business School, and Fleur Brown is the Chief Industry Affairs Officer at the Australian Retailers Association. Well, speaking of spoiling kids, more families are seeing their adult kids living at home for longer. So what does that mean for parents?
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Do you remember the moment you moved out of home? You chucked a suitcase full of stuff in your car, you headed off to the greener pastures of your first share house, free, sweet freedom, and the rest of your life ahead of you. It's the feeling of independence, finally becoming an adult, that's so exciting. But if you've got adult kids in 2025, you'll know that reaching independence can look quite different to that these days. And new research confirms what a lot of us already know, that the intensive phase of parenting doesn't stop when your child turns 18. You're probably still paying at least a few bills, providing shelter, and probably still providing a decent amount of life advice for your kids well into their 20s and beyond. So I'd love to hear about it this morning. What does it mean to be parenting your kids into adulthood? Have you had to make sacrifices? Maybe you delayed retiring or dating or taking that trip around Australia? I'd love to know what your experience has been. Tell me your story of parenting adult children. And it's something that Dr. Susie O'Brien knows all too well. She is a journalist and the national education writer with News Corp. She's got a PhD in education and also has three kids aged 21, 19 and 16. Susie, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello.
What are your kids telling you about leaving home?
Well, the two older ones are in full-time study, and so they have given me full warning that they are not moving out until they stop studying. The question is, when are they going to stop studying? I'm like despairing. Like, one of them's doing arts and law, so he's saying that's at least 5 years off. And they all want to claim their bedrooms, so they're saying, oh, well, even if I'm spending 6 months overseas, I still want the same bedroom when I get back, so I'm kind of trapped.
Yeah, you've got a PhD. You know how long it's possible to stay at a university if you really want to.
Yeah, you can make that work for as long as you can, yeah.
So, Susie, you've written that we've raised a generation of kidults. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, I mean, it was just so funny. Like, the older they get, the less docile they get, the more willing they are to kind of fight back in domestic situations. And so I've just done this piece about the kid alt saying that it's kind of a unique human species, known for its limitations in the domestic sphere. And its prime habitat is the family nest, which it will not vacate until at least they're 30. And so... they've got a surprising ability to be entirely dependent on grown-ups well past their point of maturity. And so, you know, they're very obliging. You know, kidults are willing to sit around all day in a dirty house, wait for their parents to come home and cook them dinner. And they're very happy to borrow our cars because they need petrol in theirs. And they can even, you know, lift up their feet when we're vacuuming the couch, you know, when they're lift up their feet when they're on the couch and we're vacuuming the rug.
They generously lift those feet up, Susie.
Yeah.
I don't wait for you to ask.
Like, it just at the end of it, it always comes down to the smaller stuff. Like, why is it that you make a pyramid of toilet rolls on top of the toilet instead of just putting the empty rolls on the bin, you know?
How different is this to your own upbringing, Susie?
Well, I must admit, guilty, because I didn't leave home till I was 24, and I just had it too good at home. And I remember trying to break the news to my mother and saying, "Mum, I'm moving out. I'm moving to Queensland. I went up there to do my PhD," and I expected her to be crying and, you know, a lot of tears. And she said, "Oh, well, you know, do what you need to do." And I was almost kind of sad for myself that she wasn't sadder than I was leaving. But perhaps it was time.
I thought I was the only thing in your life, Mum. Well,
yeah, come on. What are you going to do with yourself now? Come on.
Susie, your experience is actually quite representative, according to new research done by Dr. Julia Cook, who's also with me. Julia is a youth sociologist at the University of Newcastle and has been researching parents of adult kids. Julia, tell me what you're hearing when you're hearing Susie's story.
Well, as you said, it's very reflective of what I found in my study. So finding in our research, we spoke to the parents of children aged between 18 and 25, and we found that pretty much all of these children were either still living in the family home, or even those that had moved out were kind of financially supported by their parents to maintain their independent housing, and were often doing so because, you know, they needed to move away from home to pursue higher education. So that kind of level of support from parents sounds very much along the lines of what I'm finding. But in terms of how the parents understand it, I was quite struck by the fact that even though, you know, for all of the participants in my study, they did reflect, much like Susie, that, you know, their experience was a little bit kind of different to the experience of their children, but they acknowledged the kind of difficult economic circumstances surrounding their children. So, you know, they had a sense of like, okay, yes, things are different. I am providing an awful lot of support, but here's some of the reasons why that's the case. And it's not just down to, you know, a failure to launch or any of those sorts of things.
What kind of reasons did they give?
So generally it was to do with the cost of living, cost of housing, and also the kind of expectations of staying in education for longer, challenges getting a foothold in the labour market, and getting into a kind of career job. So yeah, they were very kind of cognizant of those challenges, and I think saw their role as, you know, supporting their children until they'd reached like some level of stability in a range of life domains. And I think the challenge is that point of stability is getting further and further into the future.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Dr. Julia Cook from the University of Newcastle, who's the author of a new study looking at what it's like to be a parent of adult children these days, and Dr. Susie O'Brien, who's talking about the kidults in her household and just what it's like to have a 21, 19-year-old and 16-year-old still living at home. But I'm also asking you about parenting your kids into adulthood. Maybe you've made sacrifices, maybe you think it's absolutely been worth it, or both. Tom says parenting today it's the first 40 years that are the hardest. Lynn says, we bought an 11% share in our youngest son's first apartment in the hometown we moved away from. Now his mortgage is what his rent would be. And Vaughn says, as long as those kidults are prepared to look after their parents one day in their home. Susie, what do you sort of feel like with your kidults? Is it a down payment that they will be caring for you in your old age, or do they just sort of seem to think that this is the natural way of things?
I don't think they're thinking that far ahead, to be really honest. Apologies for the background noise. I'm just in the car. I think they're just really concerned about themselves at this point. And I think they do look at my generation, the Gen Xers, and compare themselves. They say, you know, it's harder to get full-time work. It's harder to buy a house. So it's almost your fault that we're going to be at home longer. And that great rite of passage that you referred to in the intro, the share house, I mean, I was share housing in Brisbane in the 1990s in the era of that book, He Died with a Falafel in His Hand. And I had some quite similar experiences where there were, you know, odd bodies in the living room. You're not sure how long they've been there for. So I think the children are saying, we're going to miss out on some of those things. We are going to jump possibly straight from the parental home to a home of our own, and it's just going to take a whole lot longer for us to get there.
Julio, how does that track with what you're hearing from the parents in your study?
Yes, so that does track quite closely. And I'd add as well, some of the parents in my study were kind of making plans for their children to be able to stay living with them super long term. So some of them had discussed the possibility of building a granny flat on their property or extending their home to give their adult children the possibility of continuing to live at home even after they had found a partner or even potentially had children of their own. I'm not sure how realistic that is or how appealing it would be to the adult children, but I was really struck by that sort of thinking as well, that kind of long-term imagining and planning about intergenerational living.
Yeah, Julia, I've got a text here from Wendy who talked about a researcher from a few years ago who looked at the effect of having children stay at home into their adult years on the amount of savings and super available when the parents retire. And Wendy says there's a big reduction in the amounts the parents have to live on once they retire. How does that fit with your own understanding?
So that's really interesting. I've looked at some previous research that's found that supporting adult children doesn't necessarily impact the timing of retirement for parents, which I found really odd because from, you know, speaking to people, that's not really the story that I'm hearing. But in my own study, I found that the parents I was speaking to were generally planning for the money that they were going to provide to their children in the future. So they were already talking about like helping to chip in for weddings, for housing deposits. And so when they were planning, you know, how much super do I need? At what age can I realistically retire? Many of them had kind of factored that money into their planning. And some of them also kind of joked with me that they, you know, they could probably never retire, which again, I'm not sure how realistic that is, but there was a sense that they would need to, you know, continue working to continue providing that support, which is, again, pretty striking.
Yeah, Susie, I was really struck by what you said before about these sort of these kidults in your house and your own experience at, like, living in a share house. When you had kids, did you think that they would have more of your experience, or did you kind of know that you were maybe going to be on the hook for longer?
I don't think you think about it early on, but as time has gone on, it's become clearer that those kind of rites of passage, they're just not going to be able to do them. I mean, we could afford, as kind of young professionals on fairly low wages, to buy crappy houses in less desirable locations when we first sort of became workers, whereas they're just not going to be in that position. And I think, you know, like all parents, we want them to be independent, but there's no point them renting if that means that they'll never be able to buy anything down the track. So it's this idea that they kind of stay at home longer and you hope that there'll be some sort of payoff It reminds me of someone actually from Julia's study. I wrote about it. There was a dad who was saying he wanted his daughter to be more independent. So instead of driving her around, he bought her a car. I'm not sure that quite works.
Susie, have you made, like, you've made sacrifices because your kids are at home for longer than you might have expected, though?
Oh, I definitely have. And I think any plan to kind of downsize in the family home is probably the biggest one because, you know, we might be looking, if my youngest is only 16, you know, if you sort of think that they're all going to be gone by 18, job done, thank you very much, then you can kind of move into a nifty little city apartment instead of, you know, the four bedder in the suburbs. But that's not going to happen anytime soon.
On the text line, Susie, Katie has texted in saying, I'm Susie's sister. I left home at about 20, couldn't wait to get out, but I never stopped asking my parents for advice and occasionally money. But my ever generous parents never stopped giving. My dad always said, your kids are always your kids. Did you get the same treatment, or was Katie getting special treatment over here, Susie?
I couldn't read the text because I am driving, but yeah, she did just tell me that she might be ringing in. How funny. No, my parents were very generous, and I think that's why, you know, well, I stayed much longer than she did, but I don't know. Like, I think that's, there's a generosity of spirit, and you look at Julia's research, it's parents want the best for their kids, and I think that, you know, that throughout their childhood, but now it's just throughout their adulthood as well. And we're paying for it.
So, Julia, listening to what you're saying, I'm hearing that there's this real trend, and it's adults and their adult children, parents and their adult children having this together, and maybe people sort of felt like they've gotten caught off guard by it. What kind of conversations should you be having as a family with your partner, with your kids as they're getting older, about how to navigate this sort of extended living at home in your adulthood?
Well, when it comes to these kind of areas of social change where we might not have a firm idea of what exactly things are going to look like, I'm a really big advocate for, you know, having open conversations and, you know, acknowledging that these adult children are adults and it is okay to talk to them about, you know, doing more around the house and even, you know, potentially contributing financially, even if it's a small symbolic amount. So, yeah, I would advocate really strongly, have those conversations and, you know, talk about how you can live together well in a way that's, you know, working for every member of the family and is not disproportionately impacting on anyone.
Julia, Susie, thank you both so much for joining me. Dr. Julia Cook is a youth sociologist at the University of Newcastle, author of this new study into kids living at home for longer, and Dr. Susie O'Brien is a journalist and the National Education Editor with News Corp. And I've loved your texts as well. Sandor says, my kids moved out as soon as they could, both being very independent people, so I cannot talk about adult parenting. What I can contribute to is the house I grew up in. From me, freshly born, to my parents, all my mother's siblings, all my cousins, and my grandparents, never less than 15 people at the table. The most glorious youth you can think of. Another says, we're in a regional area, so my daughter moved straight after school to study, which meant I have been financially supporting her through her studies, cost of living crisis and all that. 8 years on, she's still studying, 2 degrees and now honours, so a significant financial cost. My experience at her age, it was so much easier and expected to be independent. And then this person finishes off, bring back free education. Well, stick with me. Coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, we're going to take a peek inside the wallet of a 90s star.
Elections. Being bored by them is like a national sport. Did you know just how weird and unique the Australian system is? Democracy sausage, just us. Secret ballot, we invented it. Our democratic system isn't very old, but it has a wild backstory. I'm Annabelle Crabb. Join me for a rollicking journey through Australian democracy.
Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty. Stream all the episodes on ABC iView.
In my two cents, I ask those questions that you would rather not answer about money, but I've managed to get comedians, adventurers, and musicians to disclose how they manage their money so far, as well as some of your favourites from across the ABC, like finance guru Alan Kohler and the people scientist Dr. Carl. Well, today it's actor, artist, and author Ione Skye.
I'm Ione Skye, and these days I earn my living acting, selling my memoir, and selling paintings. My last three purchases were paracetamol, ice latte, and a worn-in pink t-shirt from Bangkok at a thrift store. And this says that I love the Australian version of what we call aspirin. I like it better here. I guess I'm bougie because I feel like iced lattes are very bougie. And I just love thrift stores and t-shirts. And I'll go to a thrift store anywhere in the world. My first pay, I bought an Italian Vogue magazine that was thick and it was expensive and it felt very luxurious, and we got it as part of my mom's Christmas present, me and my brother, which was very 80s for some reason, and it stayed on our living room coffee table for so long, and I looked at it so much, and it must have influenced my sense of style because it was Italian Vogue was so interesting then, and it was an expensive Vogue, so it felt very, expensive. Growing up, money was very two different ideas. One was we had a very, like, people shouldn't have too much money. Like my grandparents, I remember talking about, like, no one should have over $1 million. It's just ridiculous. And we grew up very, feeling very lucky to have money at all. And I remember asking my mom, like, are we poor? And she was like, we're not poor compared to the world, but, you know, we're not rich at all. But then there was this other side where people were in my family, my mom, my grandparents, like, enamored with money. Like, did you see their house? And, oh my gosh, they're so wealthy. So I had two sides, one which was like, you know, bargain, don't spend money, don't be wasteful. And then the other side that was like enamored with money. So it was a kind of mixed message, but a good to have both in a way. The first house I bought was in Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles in the early 90s. And with my ex-husband, who's also a musician like my current husband, and his music money, my acting money, we bought this house in Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles. And I still have it, actually, and we're renting it. And that's fabulous because over the years, I wanted to move to New York at one point. And then you have this property that you can rent. And with the rent money, you can get a place, you know, and that's what I'm doing now with that same house. We're renting it and then we are renting in Australia. But yeah, we're thinking about moving the money not into property at this moment and looking at alternatives. How I feel about debt is there's a right way to use credit cards and a not a right way to use credit cards. Part of the move I had recently to Australia was because of debt, because I was having a dry spell. For the first time in my whole life, which was pretty lucky because I'm 55, I went into too much debt on the credit card, and that was scary. And I'm lucky enough, I never had to do that. So then my husband and I went cold turkey, no credit cards, and just we pulled our life together, everything's fine. But he recently is on tour and he's realizing tour expenses, this is the way to use a credit card. You put it all on the tour credit card and then that's sort of organized, and that's a kind of clear, organized way to use it. So I think if you use it properly, it's really good. I think about getting a gift of money quite a bit. I'm very curious about my father, who I didn't grow up with, because I have no idea if when that happens, would I get any money from him. I really have no idea. So it's almost a curiosity because we don't have that kind of relationship where we talk about that. And my mom doesn't have any money of her own, so I wouldn't be getting any inheritance. My stepfather, actually, interestingly, his job was a detective of missing heirs. He was sort of a lawyer, and he would find the closest relative if there wasn't a will, actually. If there wasn't a will, he'd find the closest relative and tell them, you have money coming to you, and sign this, and then he would get a cut. But it was a very interesting job because he's giving people money out of nowhere, and they usually don't even know this relative. So that was kind of like a fun thing for people to receive, although a lot of people were very skeptical, like, who is this person? But that was sort of, his job was like giving people money they never knew they had. My financial goals are to feel like I have savings, and if I can maintain being an artist and an actor and really lose the kind of sleepless nights. So just having a more self-sufficient, which I am, but a more consistently self-sufficient financial situation that doesn't have so many ups and downs.
Thank you so much, Ione Sky, for sharing your two cents. And I'm really hoping your stepdad shows up on my door one day and tells me that I'm a secret heiress. Well, stick with me next up on Life Matters. Should we still have unpaid internships or university placements? As the school and uni year winds down, many teenagers are about to start the next chapter of their lives. And as they look at next steps and potential careers, a common way into the workforce is through an internship, many of which are unpaid. Could be a bit of summer work experience or a mandatory placement for a university degree. Either way, unpaid work can often feel like the only way for young people to get a foot in the door. So when did working for free become the norm, and what supports are available? When does an internship stop being experience and start looking like exploitation? You're about to hear from a student advocate who is actually currently on work placement and an employment law researcher, but I'd also love to hear from you. What's your experience? Have you had to do unpaid work? Was it worth it? Well, Andrew Stewart is a professor of work and regulation at Queensland University of Technology and joins me now. Andrew, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What are we talking about when we're talking about internships? It's kind of a broad term.
They do come in all different shapes and sizes, and there's not even a lot of agreement on the terminology. So sometimes they're called internships, placements, practica, work experience. But they can range from something as short as a few days, like you might do work experience in high school, where you're going to spend a little bit of time in a workplace, not necessarily doing any work as such, but just simply observing what people do. And then the other end of the spectrum, you can have arrangements which run over 1 or 2 years where you're doing what can be paid but also sometimes unpaid work that, you know, it can often be indistinguishable from employment. So we've got a big range there, and there's also a massive range in terms of quality, because sometimes in the very best internships or placements, what you're getting is a highly structured program of training that's giving you new skills, or it's allowing you to practice existing ones. And then the other end of the spectrum, the internship, you could just be making coffee, taking your boss's dry cleaning, doing all kinds of menial tasks in the hope that just by being around a workplace, you're somehow going to get the contacts and, you know, the line you can put on your CV that'll make all the difference to getting a job. And then, of course, there's the really big difference. You might be paid exactly the same as an employee for doing that kind of work. That's true in a lot of commercial law firms, for example. Mm. You might be paid considerably less than what an employee would get, but there are also a ton of completely unpaid internships. And that's a particular concern if you're coming from a background where it's not easy to be able to work for free and, you know, still be able to survive.
What are the industries where you're seeing this the most, especially the unpaid work?
Well, there are some where it's just built into the system of professional training. So if you want to be a teacher, a nurse, a doctor, a lawyer, you have to go through some period of work experience. So the original interns, for example, are from the medical profession. But in that case, those doctors are typically being paid. But for a lot of university students these days, or TAFE students, to be able to complete your degree, you have to take on what may be an unpaid placement over quite a considerable period of time. And then outside that, outside of like the formal training, we've seen what are sometimes called open market internships become really, really popular with firms who are using them to trial workers, sometimes, frankly, just to get free labour. Mm. But we see this particularly in industries where there's an oversupply of graduates for a small number of jobs. So journalism, for example. Yeah, I mean, I've been researching this area for a number of years. There's not too many, you know, people I've spoken to in the media over that time who haven't had their own experiences of doing some form of internship. But we also see it, you know, in accountancy, engineering, IT, marketing, event management, tourism, any area where a lot of graduates all competing for a small number of jobs.
Well, also with me is James Sheriff, who is a third-year teaching student, currently on placement, and also co-founder of Students Against Placement Poverty. James, if you don't mind me asking, you're on placement. Are you getting paid for it?
I am actually at the moment, yeah, which is very fortunate. I'm very glad to be on placement and also able to afford rent.
Yeah, it feels like when you say it like that, you're like, yeah, that really should be the bare minimum, but it's not a given in lots of industries.
No, and that's why we started the Students Against Placement Poverty campaign. I mean, you know, when it started, it was a couple of us ranting about how frustrating it is to have to see this practical or placement burden, I guess, this learning opportunity, to see it as a burden. Most of us are very excited to go on BRAC and very excited to go on placement because it's a really amazing learning opportunity, and you get to really see the industry firsthand and up close and learn a huge amount more than you do necessarily in a university classroom. But, you know, when it's can be up to 6, 7, 8 weeks unpaid. It's a huge stumbling block for a lot of students. So the campaign really started as a way to kind of address that issue of people actually just falling short at the halfway point or the three-quarter mark of their degree and having to drop out. So, you know, that's where the placement poverty comes into it. You know, we didn't want people to actually be falling into rental stress, to homelessness, and having to drop out of their degrees and make those sort of really difficult choices.
So this payment for people on PRAC is a relatively new thing thanks to your advocacy. What did it look like a couple of years ago?
Yeah, well, a couple of years ago, I mean, when we started the campaign, we were getting stories from people who were living in their cars during placement. You know, I'm sure you know, like a lot of people who move into degrees like teaching or social work or nursing and allied health, you know, a lot of people might be starting that, you know, straight out of school and going into it living at home. But a lot of people are career changers. They've got, you know, rent, they've got responsibilities, you know, single parents. So, you know, a few years ago or even just up until the middle of this year, people were having to make really difficult choices. And at this point now, we can at least have access in teaching, social work and nursing to a $300-ish dollar a week payment if you meet the eligibility criteria, which can help you, you know, just stay afloat. But when we started the campaign, I mean, we were tossing around these ideas. It took a while for us to think that it would really work. And now that it has gotten over the line and we've actually been able to make change, I think a lot of people still want it to see it expanded, to see it pushed into other industries and to cover, you know, cohorts like international students, who a huge number of them are studying in these degrees.
Yeah, the criteria is still relatively narrow. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to James Sheriff, who's a third-year teaching student and co-founder of Students Against Placement Poverty, and Andrew Stewart, who's a professor of work and regulation at QUT, talking about unpaid internships or low-paid internships and work experience, and just the push and pull of how valuable they can be for people who are trying to enter an industry, and how exploitative they can be depending on the circumstances. I'd love to know whether you've had to do unpaid work and whether you reckon it was worth it. Simon has texted saying, I'm a small employer and have always done paid trials. It's a costly policy, but I think it's important to value your potential staff's time, and it gets our employer-employee relationship off to a respectful start. But many places take advantage of young employees and it gives us all a bad name. Another says, friend worked full-time while doing degree but cannot finalise it till he can afford to do 3 months within a time limit unpaid internship. His wife works full-time, two kids, a mortgage and hex debt. No wonder young adults do not leave home. Yeah, in reference to what we were talking about just before. Well, Andrew, is there any sign that this is going to change? We heard James talking about the placement poverty, but it really only covers students from a specific number of degrees.
Yeah, so there's, again, we can probably look at this in two different ways. One is what's going on within the education sector, and then what's going on outside. Within the education sector, we still have this situation where it's perfectly lawful to have an unpaid placement for an unlimited period of time. So that really shouldn't be the case. What we've seen in other countries is the introduction of time limits, the introduction of a rule that if you have a placement that runs over a certain period of time, it has to be paid rather than being unpaid. So although the new Pratt placement that the Albanese government's introduced is certainly a help, to the students who are eligible for it. As you've heard, there's a lot of students who aren't eligible, and there really ought to be more limitations, as well as quality requirements, greater quality requirements, if universities or TAFE institutions or other educational training providers are going to insist on a period of work experience. Outside that, then we're in the outside the education training system, then we're in the area where there's a lot of uncertainty about what's legal and what isn't. The Fair Work Ombudsman has done a lot over the last decade to try and crack down on businesses who are really misusing and exploiting the willingness of people to work for free. There's still, a lot of sign that there are a lot of exploitative arrangements out there. And again, it would be better if we had greater clarity in the law about when an internship has to be paid and when it doesn't, and greater levels of enforcement to try and crack down, on the worst examples of these arrangements.
Andrew, briefly, what should people do if they think they're being exploited?
Well, you can get in touch with the Fair Work Ombudsman, so fairwork.gov.au. There have been a number of instances over the years where the Ombudsman has intervened on behalf of people who are in internships where they felt they weren't being properly treated. And, we've seen the Ombudsman be able to get pay for them. So that's certainly an option. If you're a union member, obviously you turn to your trade union, but for a lot of young people today, they're not members of unions at all, and they're particularly unlikely to be members if they're doing work unpaid. So, the Fair Work Ombudsman is the best option. There's a section on their website which talks about unpaid work, which will give you an idea about what should be okay and what shouldn't from a legal point of view. But look, the main point I'd say, I think to anyone who's thinking about doing an unpaid internship, but particularly if you're not being required to by the degree you're taking, the evidence suggests that doing an unpaid internship doesn't actually make any difference on average to being able to get a job. Paid internships, on the other hand, where those are available, and they are still available in parts of the labour market, the evidence suggests that they really do improve the average job seeker's chance of finding paid employment. So the employer that's doing the right thing and prepared to pay you while they're training you, while they're giving an opportunity to you, while they're having a look at you to see whether they want to employ you, those are the better kinds of arrangements to look out for.
Andrew,
unfortunately,
James,
they don't grow on trees.
Oh yeah, that's the truth. We do have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Andrew Stewart, Professor of Work and Regulation at Queensland University of Technology, and James Sheriff, third-year teaching student, currently on placement, co-founder of Students Against Placement Poverty. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. We'll be back again with you tomorrow talking about how long you would be happy for your mortgage period to be if it meant you could actually afford your payments. Lenders are extending loan periods to 40 years. They're talking about 50 years in the US. What does it mean for the Australian dream? Plus, what it's like coming to Australia today versus 50 years ago as Australia welcomes its 1 millionth refugee. I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.